I'm Matt Katz, a reporter at WNYC, in for Tanzina Vega all week. This is The Takeaway. We're going to start today by talking about the death penalty, a topic that has grown increasingly divisive in recent years. While some states like Virginia and Colorado have recently moved to abolish it, others have looked for ways to continue executing people on death row, even as some of the execution methods have become increasingly difficult or even impractical. Last week, South Carolina entered the fray. Governor Henry McMaster signed a bill requiring people on death row to choose between firing squad or the electric chair if lethal injection isn't available.
The death penalty, which has been in South Carolina for, I think, since the very beginning, was not able to function because of the way our particular one was written, and that has now been accomplished, has been fixed, so that justice may proceed.
Mississippi, Utah, and Oklahoma are the only other states that currently allow the use of firing squads.
There's no humane way to kill a human being. I don't view the firing squad any better than the electric chair, lethal injection, or otherwise.
That was South Carolina State Representative Justin Bamberg on MSNBC speaking in opposition to the new law. Under South Carolina's previous law, lethal injection was the primary mode of execution. But there's been a shortage of those drugs in recent years as manufacturers have grown weary of being tied to the death penalty. And that's led to a major showdown in executions for South Carolina, which hasn't carried out an execution in roughly 10 years. There are currently 37 people on death row in the state, with three of them having exhausted all of their appeals. So what will this new law mean for South Carolina, and how does it fit into the current state of death penalty policies nationwide? For that and more, we're joined now by Victoria Hansen, reporter for South Carolina Public Radio based in Charleston. Victoria, glad to have you here.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Also with us is Marie Shema, staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of Let the Lord Sort Them, The Rise and Fall of the Death Penalty. Maurice, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. Great to be with you.
Good to be with you too. Victoria, we'll start with you. It's been about 10 years since the last execution took place in South Carolina. Why the delay? What's been going on?
Well, Matt, as you mentioned right there off the top, the problem has been that the state has not been able to get the chemicals needed for lethal injection from pharmaceutical companies, especially without a shield like other states have that protect the identity of the company that's selling the drugs for execution. So as you mentioned, while lethal injection is the default method, the choice was between lethal injection and the electric chair. But without those drugs, they couldn't carry out the executions. So as they debated this most recent legislation, this newly passed legislation, there were three death row inmates who had exhausted all their appeals on death row, execution stayed, who could not be put to death because they had not chosen the electric chair.
So now they will have a choice to choose between the electric chair and firing squad, and they will be presented that choice when it's their time. Is that how this is going to work, Victoria?
That is how it's supposed to work. And again, lethal injection is still an option if it is available. And that is a big if. Again, the inmates must decide between the electric chair and the firing squad, with the electric chair now being the default method. The electric chair is now the default method of execution, and it was last used in 2008.
Is there a firing squad ready to go? Is it already up and available to do this, or do they have to work that out?
No, there is no firing squad. In fact, the state needs to create one. And the Department of Corrections is looking to other states that currently use this method, like Mississippi, Oklahoma, and Utah. There's no word on just how long this will take, what it will cost. But here's the catch. The state may be able to carry out executions by electric chair, even if a firing squad is not available. Because while inmates do have a choice, the electric chair, again, is now the default method.
Maurice, Victoria mentioned these three other states that do use firing squads. How frequently are firing squads used in those states?
Very rarely. It's only been used in the last 50 or so years in Utah. The last time was in 2010, and then before that, there were a couple of times going back to the 70s. But Utah will end up being sort of the source of expertise for South Carolina or other states who try to carry out executions this way. Similarly, the electric chair, although used a little more frequently and used, you know, more than 100 times in the past half century or so, is pretty rare, and Tennessee is kind of the dominant state now that uses it. Most states still use lethal injection because they have managed to find those drugs.
And what has been the issue with finding the drugs for lethal injections? What are the concerns from the pharmaceutical companies that provide the drugs?
Sure. So about
Various?
10 years ago, activists who opposed the death penalty kind of prevailed on pharmaceutical companies to stop letting their drugs be used for this purpose. They helped them enact what were called distribution controls so that the drugs wouldn't get into the hands of prison agencies. The prisons kind of scrambled in response and started enlisting, sometimes actually overseas sources. Some of them went to India to try and Europe to try to get sources of drugs. Sometimes they would enlist sort of small independent compounding pharmacies to make pentobarbital and other lethal injection drugs. And so you would hear these sort of salacious stories of them, you know, buying the drugs with cash, taxpayer money, you know, going in a suitcase, some illicit sounding scheme to get the drugs. This was all generally considered legal, but as Victoria said, you know, even small independent pharmacies don't necessarily want the kind of PR problem of being the source of execution drugs. And so it's gotten harder and harder for states to get these drugs and also more and more expensive. Recently, Arizona was on record for paying more than $1 million for execution drugs.
Maurice, you've done so much reporting on the death penalty. I'm curious about the people who will be firing these bullets in these firing squads. What mental toll do executions tend to take on the people who are tasked with observing them or carrying them out?
It's a good question. I mean, we know broadly speaking that the experience of working at an execution, not just, you know, strapping the prisoner down to a lethal injection gurney or a electric chair, but even escorting them into the room, interacting with them the day of their death is you know, horribly traumatic. It exacts a really intense mental toll. Many of the executioners that I interviewed for my book, many of them managed to get on with their lives, but none of them described the experience as being other than, you know, very, very difficult. And some of them retired or, you know, had to go into therapy or even had kind of nervous breakdowns from the experience. I think that the firing squad, because it is such a dramatic form of execution, and it looks so violent, will be hard for people to watch. And I think the fact that it's hard to watch is maybe part of why it has not been more popular over the last 50 years. Because logistically, and to speak sort of frankly, it is kind of a more surefire method of execution than lethal injection.
Victoria, you recently spoke with South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster about this new law. What did he have to say about it?
Yeah, the governor says this is necessary. They've been trying to do this for some time. He says the families of victims need to get the justice that they were promised in court. Most Republicans have been in favor, but you know, some say they were conflicted. You know, even though this was not a debate about the death penalty itself, if they have been pro-life when it has come to talking about bills about abortion, how can they not be pro-life when it comes to capital punishment? And I have to mention, already there have been lawsuits filed.
You know, Maurice, people sometimes are sentenced to die but are later exonerated, found to be innocent for their crimes. There was a case recently in Arkansas. Newly uncovered DNA evidence would have exonerated a black man there who was executed in 2017. How significant of a factor are wrongful convictions in the argument against the death penalty?
I think that wrongful convictions have long been a sort of big driver of opposition to the death penalty. At this point, there's been roughly one exoneration, one person freed from death row because they were innocent for every eight executions, which is just a very high rate of error. And I have seen that this argument that the system, you know, gets it wrong sometimes is especially compelling to conservatives. to Republicans. You know, some Republicans came out against the firing squad bill in South Carolina. In Oklahoma, they've been filing bills that make it easier for death row prisoners to make arguments of innocence in court. There are many bills around the rest of the country and state legislatures brought by Republicans that would limit who get the death penalty. And I think there's this increasing realization that if, as conservatives, they oppose big government, sort of out of control taxpayer spending and the government's ability to kind of swoop in on your life and limit your liberty, that the death penalty is kind of the ultimate example of that.
Mm-hmm. And Maurice, nationally, during the 2020 campaign, President Biden said he would work to pass legislation ending the death penalty at the federal level. Has he done anything in this regard since taking office?
He has not. A group of Democratic lawmakers in Congress have brought a bill recently. The first Republican signed on to that bill. And so there is this bill kind of active in Congress, but Biden himself has not done a whole lot. His priorities have been elsewhere. There is quite a bit that he could do even behind the scenes. You know, he could help improve defense for those facing the death penalty at the state level. He could just issue a moratorium. He could even go so far as to commute the sentences of those on federal death row, which I think would be a fairly controversial thing to do. But my sense is that at the moment in Congress, it still feels like a fairly partisan issue. And Biden, as we've seen in other cases, is sort of not eager to wade into what can feel like culture war battles.
Victoria, who's on death row in South Carolina? What are the racial demographics?
Right. So there are 37 inmates who are currently on death row. 19 of those are Black.
And that's reflective of those who are on death row nationally, right, Maurice?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's now been pretty well shown that the death penalty's roots go back many years, and some of those roots are in lynchings and the lynchings that disproportionately targeted Black Americans. That continues to be true, not just in the disparities on death row being, you know, more Black prisoners, but also if a victim is white, it's often been found that it's more likely that the defendant will get the death penalty regardless of their race. So there's a lot of ways in which race kind of skews who ends up getting the ultimate punishment.
Victoria, before I let you guys go, what are you watching for next when it comes to South Carolina death penalty cases?
All right, well, a couple of things. As I mentioned, that lawsuit filed on behalf of two of the inmates whose executions had been stayed because of the lack of chemicals. This law is retroactive, and they claim it's unconstitutional to have a method of execution changed by a law that did not exist when they were sentenced to death. The other is the third inmate whose execution was stayed, Richard Moore. The state Supreme Court is now hearing his case again. He was tried by an all-white jury.
Victoria Hansen is a reporter for South Carolina Public Radio, and Maurice Shema is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. Guys, thank you so much for joining us and explaining this issue to us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This week, the Supreme Court announced they will be taking on a controversial case that places in question the future of abortion rights in this country. The case comes out of Mississippi and deals with a law the state legislature passed in 2018 that would ban abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. For anti-abortion advocates, the Supreme Court's decision to hear the case is seen as a promising step. In recent years, conservative lawmakers have worked to pass anti-abortion bill after anti-abortion bill, hoping one would be taken to the Supreme Court. It's part of a strategy which anti-abortion advocates hope will ultimately overturn Roe v. Wade, eroding abortion access on a national level. I'm joined now by Emma O'Connor, national reporter for BuzzFeed News. Emma, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us what this case is about. What are the justices going to be looking at?
The case is about, as you said, the law bans abortion after 15 weeks, after the fetus has gone through 15 weeks of gestation. Specifically, it's called the Gestational Age Act, unless there is a severe fetal abnormality that would prevent the fetus from surviving outside of the womb, or if there's a medical emergency threatening the life of the pregnant person. And then in basically any other situation, doctors could have their licenses revoked or face a fine. But not criminal penalties. The case mainly focuses around the idea of viability. And viability means the fetus's ability to live outside the womb. at 15 weeks with current technology, that is virtually impossible. It's hard to say that anything in the world has never happened, but it's basically just not something that can currently happen. The team arguing on Dobbs's side of the case. So Dr. Thomas Dobbs is Mississippi's state health director, and he's being sued by the state's last abortion clinic, Jackson Women's Health, to prevent the law from going into effect back in 2018 when it was passed. So those are the plaintiffs in the case. And on Dobbs's side, they are arguing that science is developing so quickly that the idea of viability, which started in Roe when Roe v. Wade was passed in 1973, started at 28 weeks. In the 90s, with another major abortion case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, that went down to 24 weeks. It's now about 22 to 24 weeks that people think that a fetus could live viably outside the womb with the aid of an incubator and other medical intervention. And Dobbs is arguing that in the future, that will go down and down and down and down. And so we should prepare for future technologies like, and this is actually said in the petition, an artificial womb that could potentially keep a fetus alive at 15 weeks or younger. Courts so far have dismissed this argument and said that it doesn't really make sense to plan for technological developments that don't yet exist. And they also, the idea of viability, the idea that banning an abortion before a fetus can live outside the womb is so essential to abortion rights in this country. It was written about in Roe v. Wade. It was written about in almost every single decision since then, that even conservative Trump-appointed judges who have heard this case have said that this violates the Constitution. And that's why it's such a positive sign for anti-abortion advocates and such a negative sign for abortion rights advocates that the Supreme Court has chosen to take this up instead of just dismissing it and relying on the opinions of all of the judges that heard this as it moved up in the courts.
This was a surprise that the Supreme Court decided to take this, right?
Yeah, it was a surprise in some ways. It was a surprise because of how established this is. The way that it's kind of less of a surprise is in June Medical Services v. Russo, Justice Roberts, he opposed it. The Trump appointees on the court, not Barrett, because she had not joined yet. And then the other conservative justices, they all, you know, they were all pro this law going into effect, and the liberal justices understandably were against it. And Robert surprisingly sided with the liberal justices, but he wrote a separate opinion from Justice Breyer saying that the reason that he was opposed to this law is because it was identical to a law that they had struck down in 2016 in Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt. And that law, literally word for word identical. And he said that he thought that that decision was wrongly decided, but the fact that they had just made that decision about basically the exact same law so recently means that he like could not change from that decision. But he very strongly indicated to anti-abortion advocates that he would be opened to re-examining Planned Parenthood v. Casey. And basically the whole idea of undue burden, it's like viability and undue burden are like the two key words that like anybody who talks about abortion and the Supreme Court just say all the time. And basically undue burden is a standard that was developed in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which was in 1992, that has this idea that laws cannot place an undue burden on a woman seeking an abortion. Meaning if a law, for example, says that a woman has to travel one state over, has to stay overnight, has to come back for another appointment again, has to spend hours listening to a script, that going through that is so difficult that it almost makes getting the abortion possible. And that's an undue burden. And Roberts basically said in his dissent in June that he would be willing to re-examine that standard, and he would be willing to re-examine whether Planned Parenthood versus Casey was correctly decided, but the case that was brought before him there just didn't do that. So in saying that, he basically signaled to anti-abortion advocates that he was down to hear a case like this. So in that way, it's less of a surprise.
So Emma, we've been talking about this case and how it got there. I'm curious if you could take us back to the beginning of the Trump presidency. What were anti-abortion politicians and groups attempting to do? did getting this kind of case before the court represent their long-term strategy here?
Yeah, so I might actually take you back a little bit further. Now I'm kind of more of a generalist, but for a long time I was BuzzFeed's reproductive rights reporter. So I've really been very like deep in this strategy and talking to people on both sides of it for a really long time. So I watched this unfold. The year that Trump was elected, the strategy really changed. Before that, the standard was passing these trap laws, as abortion rights advocates refer to them, which was, you know, the admitting privileges. It's things like regulating the size of hallways in abortion clinics, which, you know, sounds kind of harmless. And when you first see it and you read it, like, you think it's just like a building ordinance. Like, it doesn't really sound like much, but in reality, it's designed to make clinics close down because they are unable to renovate the entire building to expand the hallways to the regulation size. They just don't have the money to do that. So a lot of the times they were closing down. So there were a whole bunch of kind of under the radar, complicated, hard to read laws that were being passed that sounded like a line on your insurance claim, but in actuality was kind of disintegrating access to abortion across the country. So that was a strategy for a very, very long time. When Trump was elected, he had vowed to appoint pro-life, anti-abortion Supreme Court justices to specifically overturn Roe v. Wade. And that's how you get to the Mississippi law. So the Mississippi law is sort of, it's a more severe version of that based on kind of this 20-week ban. They brought it down to 15.
So let's say the court upholds the constitutionality of this law banning abortions after 15 weeks. What are the potential national effects? Is it just massive?
Yes, it's pretty severe. I mean, it's, you know, they could make a whole bunch of different decisions. They could just outright overturn Roe v. Wade. That's always a possibility. The general idea is that they don't love doing things like that because it's so extreme, and the Supreme Court likes to be seen as, you know, just the kind of temperate decision of the land kind of staying out of politics. But the very fact that they took up this case is not that. So they might just overturn Roe v. Wade entirely, in which case every state will be able to decide for itself whether or not to ban abortion at any time period. I think there's a common misconception that Roe is overturned, then abortion will be illegal across the country. And that's not the case. It will stay legal in liberal states, and it will likely become illegal in conservative states, in which case you will see a lot of traveling to have abortions. Then another possibility is that they start dismantling it slowly. Maybe they say, okay, 15 weeks is the cutoff for viability now. So then there's a whole bunch of bans currently in the courts that are 15 weeks or even 6 weeks or lower, 8 weeks. And so those bans, the 6 weeks, 8 week bans, if the court specifically decides that 15 weeks is the cutoff, then those might not go into effect. But anything over 15 weeks, which there are also a lot of, so there's a lot of 20 weeks, as I said, there's 18 weeks, those will be able to go into effect basically immediately because a lot of them are currently in the court system. So that would actually affect the decision of the judges that are considering them.
Thank you, Emma. Emma O'Connor is a national reporter for BuzzFeed News. Emma, we appreciate you joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I got my potato
on Radiolab,
and I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
Been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
When the pandemic hit last year and forced millions of Americans to socially distance themselves at home to curb the spread of the virus, it also meant that millions of people lost their jobs. The stock market plunged amidst the uncertainty, and restaurants, retailers, airliners, and hotels saw their foot traffic decline significantly. But something that many of us didn't expect was that the pandemic and all of the extra time we spent at home would translate into a housing boom. Individuals and households with means jumped at the opportunity to get into the market, with interest rates at historic lows and new flexible work-from-home schedules. Some participated in bidding wars and made offers on homes sight unseen. Here's what you told us.
Hi, this is Yvette calling from Temecula, California. We sold our house super fast for way more than the asking price. It was a head-spinning experience, and we felt super, super lucky.
I purchased a home in Salt Lake City, Utah in February of 2020, and then the pandemic hit, and I assumed that I had purchased at the top of the housing market, and I could not have been more wrong. I ended up selling my home just 10 months later for $60,000 more than I had purchased it. In fact, I received a cash offer for $10,000 over asking price within 4 hours of it being listed, and I was thrilled until I started looking to buy another home. It took me 2.5 months, 17 offers, all over asking price, before I finally was able to win a bid and purchase a different new home for more than I had actually sold my first home. That is the housing market in Salt Lake City, Utah, and this is Heather.
But climbing prices and a limited supply of homes for sale have also highlighted inequalities in the housing market. Joining me now to discuss her reporting on the U.S. housing market and who stands to benefit from the boom is Rani Mulla, senior data reporter at Vox's Recode. Rani, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So, Rani, I'd like you to react with what we just heard from listeners. Do those stories, those anecdotes, track with what you found in your reporting?
Oh, absolutely. I heard a lot of similar anecdotes when I was reporting. You know, just people getting these crazy number of offers on their homes if they're selling it, and then people trying to buy homes just really being out of luck, you know, having to make these offers so much higher than they expected, competing with tons of other people, and people offering just, you know, cash, which is, you know, sort of unheard of.
What happened? Why is this happening? And what does it have to do with the pandemic?
So there's like there's a confluence of reasons having to do with both supply and demand. On the demand side, first of all, as you said, the pandemic, a lot of people have been stuck at home. They've been teaching their kids at home. They've been in their home, you know, 24 hours a day. So it's made it a lot more important to have a bigger house, to have a nice space, to have outdoor space. So that was one impetus for people to be like, okay, you know, maybe I'm going to get out of my apartment and I'm going to buy a house. You also have millennials aging into the time when they're going to buy their first or maybe second homes. There's also really low mortgage rates. And then on the supply side, you have just limited numbers of houses being built since the last housing bubble, which sort of decimated the construction industry. You also have high lumber prices. You have a lot of people who are unwilling to put their homes on the market during the pandemic or holding onto their homes longer. Finally, you also have investors who are buying up existing and new homes to make them into rental properties. So that's taking a lot of them off of the market. So you have all of these reasons that are making the housing market just so hot and expensive.
Interesting. And on the last point, the investors are buying these homes and then renting them. Is that how they're handling their investments?
Yeah, I mean, a good portion of them are. There's one estimate from John Burns Real Estate that says something like 20% of all home buying activity is for investment properties. And that could be any number of things, you know, just holding on to it, having the price go up. But a lot of that is for rentals. And that's a trend that started after the last housing boom when all of these foreclosed houses were in the market. Investors came in there and they bought houses on the cheap and flipped them in order to rent them out to people.
Rani, how does the volume of homes compare to the demand from buyers? Do you have any numbers, approximations on that?
I know that the demand is far outstripping the supply. The last time people were buying this number of houses was, you know, 2006, right at the height of the housing bubble, you know, the run up to the housing bubble. So we have tons of people buying houses and there's just not enough homes to meet their demand.
You wrote in one of your recent stories that the rise of single family rentals is one of the many trends portending the erosion of personal ownership. And this is not just personal ownership of homes, right? Can you expand on that for us?
Right. There's all sorts of stuff that people no longer own. We used to buy CDs and now we spend 10 bucks a month on Spotify. You know, if you want, you could have a subscription for, you know, your toothbrush, but there's other things like farm equipment that, you know, you would think that you could buy outright, but the companies that make this farm equipment own the software. And, you know, it's this larger trend where people own fewer and fewer things, and we're basically renting or leasing out stuff that we formerly owned. And that has a lot of repercussions for like the amount of control we have over the things that we think we own.
And then repercussions for accumulating wealth and passing down generational wealth too. Right?
Absolutely. That's especially the case with homes. You know, these, they're worth hundreds of thousands of, if not more, dollars. And if you're constantly paying rent, you, at the end of the day, don't have anything to sell. And at the end of your life, don't have anything to pass down to your children. So this has a lot of potential repercussions for how people establish wealth. If you're able to buy a home, you know, that's pretty meaningful. As far as extending that wealth.
Sure. Yeah. How do home ownership rates right now compare across races?
So overall, home ownership rates are pretty high. They're around 65%, but it's much higher for white people than it is for Black people. And that's historically been the case. The home ownership rates are always higher for whites. The fear is that with these prices just skyrocketing, that's going to further make it less likely for Blacks to be able to afford homes. You know, part of the reasons for the lower home ownership rates were lower incomes to begin with, also redlining, you know, not offering them the mortgages that they might offer white people. So this is just going to push it further out of reach for Americans making less money.
Sure. Who else has been boxed out of this opportunity to home buy in this red hot market? Does it mean that, you know, the rising home prices and the reduced supply mean that certain demographics just are not able to get involved in this market to buy homes?
It's boxed out just a lot of people, who might have pretty good jobs, you know, might have a good amount of money saved up, but it's just not enough money anymore. So these are people who you'd in years past would obviously be ready to buy a home. And now with home prices the way they are, they just simply can't afford it. So they end up in a lot of cases trying to get the same things that you would get in a home, but having to do so by renting.
Yeah. So where does this go? What's going to happen? I mean, is this a real estate bubble that will eventually pop?
Well, the thing is, housing prices tend to go up. Even, you know, remember, while all this was happening, we were in the middle of a recession and the pandemic was happening and the housing prices were still going up. Obviously, the last recession was a different story that was predicated on bad loans to too many houses. But this doesn't seem to be the case in this one. You know, people are putting a lot more money down. They have better credit. So I guess what could happen is so many people will be priced out that the prices will have to slow down. You know, that'll eventually happen. It's just once that happens, the prices have already gone up so much that it's made it out of reach for so many people. I believe in the last year, home prices went up about 10%, and typically they go up like 3%, maybe 5%. So that's just completely out of lockstep with how fast people's incomes are rising.
Yeah, the market is nuts. And what about the renter's market? Is that going up kind of at the same rate?
It's not going up at the same rate. So rents are certainly going up, but just nowhere near as fast as, and these are home rent for like renting a home. They're going up and nowhere near as fast as the price of homes. So more and more renting a home is becoming like the more affordable option, but you know, that's still getting more expensive as well.
So who is affording these houses at increasingly astronomical prices? Is there a particular demographic that is grabbing these places before other people?
I mean, the simple answer is people with a lot of money. I mean,
rich
people. You know, this is another example of people, you know, like the divide in America of wealthier people getting wealthier and poorer people getting poorer. You have a lot of people who, I believe there was someone on the call who's saying, you know, I sold my house and I sold it for way more than I expected to, and it sold it really fast. And I talked to some people like that as well. So these are people who already had a home, you know, already are in an upper income bracket because they were able to purchase a home previously. And now they just got even more money for their home. The problem is, you know, they might not be able to afford another home. Sure. So, but yeah, I think, yeah, wealthier people will be able to get wealthier because of this.
And before I let you go, I'm curious if people who are buying homes or looking for certain amenities, maybe related to the pandemic that we're all still living through, are there certain things that home buyers want in their homes now that maybe they didn't want before?
I think again, you just hear people want more space. They want more space, yeah, and they want outdoor space. Those are really important. And, you know, after a year spent in, you know, inside in people's apartments without access to like a nice place to be outside, you could see why, sure, they'd want that.
In my neighborhood, there are roof decks going up all over the place on houses that have just sold or that are about to be sold.
That's a really good idea.
In the urban area, yes. So
if
people
could afford
are going
the lumber.
Yeah, that's right, because you've reported that lumber prices are also going up, which is also part of this, in the mix with all of this.
Right.
Very interesting. Ronnie Mola is a senior data reporter at Vox's Recode. Ronnie, thanks a lot for explaining this all to us.
Thanks for having me.
Back in the early 2000s, you might be surprised to learn that I, now a news reporter at WNYC, had a popular nationally syndicated dating column based out of the newspaper I worked at in New Jersey. There were even three billboards, maybe four, in southern New Jersey with my oversized face advertising the column, which was called The Bachelor Pad. The pad being my notepad, get it? As I covered the seismic changes in dating at the turn of the century, particularly due to the internet, the billboard read, "Get a date with Matt Katz." 13 years of blissful marriage and two kids later, I still think about how relationships and sex and technology intersect. And now this retired dating columnist wonders, what has the pandemic meant for our romantic relationships and sex lives? What's going to change in all of that as the number of fully vaccinated people continues to rise? Will the coming months be a hot vax summer or summer of love like social media might have you believe? Or are people more interested in finding a partner instead of hooking up? Let's talk about it. With me is Dr. Amanda Gesselman, Associate Director for Research at Indiana University's Kinsey Institute. The Kinsey Institute recently unveiled the results of a national survey looking at the impact of COVID-19 on people's relationships and sex lives. Amanda, glad to have you with us.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I'm curious, because there's been so many jokes and memes about, quote, shot girl summer. But your research shows that people aren't exactly looking for hookups this summer, right? Why is commitment actually hot right now?
Well, people have been stuck in their house for over a year, and a lot of people have been socially isolated, which is, has evolutionarily and historically been very hard for us to psychologically tolerate. So people are really very much looking for connection, for that emotional connection, that intimate connection. And our survey showed that. So we did survey 2,000 people at the end of January. This was in combination or collaboration, I should say, with the magazines Cosmo and Esquire. And we surveyed people about what they're looking for in terms of love and sex after the pandemic, which is what everyone wants to know, basically. Mm-hmm. But we were really interested in especially whether or not people would be, like you said, like once the pandemic, the threat sort of, you know, fades out or abates, are people just going to go out and have lots of sex? Are people looking for, you know, that whole wax and vax thing? Are people looking for lots of sex, but no real commitment? And we didn't find that at all. So of our sample, 44% of people, so almost half of people, said that committed relationships are more important to them now than they were before the pandemic. And these are single. So these are what people are seeking out. So almost half of them said that they're even more important to them now than they used to be. While only 14% said that they're less important to them than they used to be. And on the flip side, we also asked, of course, about, seeking out a variety of sex partners, and only 15% of people said that idea that, you know, sexual variety, going out and finding the, you know, casual sex, only 15% of people said that that was more important to them now than it was before the pandemic. And only about 20% of people said that it was equally important.
So interesting. And what about how comfortable people are feeling dating right now? What does your research show about that? Is the comfort level trending upward as more and more people get vaccinated?
Yeah, so it seems that more and more people are definitely ready to date. People are sort of, you know, we've all had enough of this, I think. Yes. But especially people who, you know, were trying to date before, or were trying to find a partner or a connection before, and then had that completely just destroyed with the pandemic. People are ready to get out there. You know, the majority of our participants are telling us that they're ready to date, that they've, you know, already been scoping out the online apps, that they've been, you know, chatting with partners, video chatting, and they're definitely ready to get back into the in-person dating. So I think that we're probably going to see a big rush of that once it's safe to do so.
And are people worried about social anxiety or exposure to COVID? I mean, the fears might be a little bit different than normally, right? I mean, you don't get the same sort of butterflies that you might on a first date. There's all kinds of other worries maybe circulating in the back of your head.
Yeah, there's a lot of competition for what to worry about now, I think, and which isn't great. But, you know, this is an unprecedented time. We're all struggling with it. And so I think a lot of people are struggling with their own concerns without thinking about how everyone is also struggling with this. But of course we ask them what they're worried about when they go back to the dating market, or, you know, they get back out there. And we found that the number one concern for all age groups, men and women, all sexual orientations, et cetera, the number one was finding someone who wants commitment. That was over 1 in 10 people said that was their number one concern, just being able to find someone who wants what they want. And that is a big concern, because before the pandemic, we know that most people weren't telling other people what kind of relationship they wanted. Especially in online dating, which is the primary way to meet partners for basically all demographics now. So people were using these online dating services, but no one was ever telling anyone what kind of relationship they wanted. Do you want casual sex? Do you want a hookup? Do you want just to date, you know, a few times? Are you looking for a relationship? So this is now people's number one concern, finding someone who wants that commitment. And that seems to be the concern for everyone. With the second one being figuring out how to protect my own mental health. And I think that might come from the idea of being, you know, isolated for a year, and now we have to think about possibly being rejected, you know, getting our hopes up, trying to make those connections, and just having, you know, having people not want that with us, not accept us, or, you know, just generally setting ourselves up for disappointment. So I think a lot of people are also a bit concerned about that as well.
You know, new trends popped up during the pandemic when it comes to dating. Online dating sites offered video dates. You found that a third of women reported sexting during the pandemic, and a majority intend to continue. Are there trends that we saw during the pandemic when it comes to dating that are here to stay?
Yeah, I know that a lot of people have told me in passing that they think video dating is very awkward, but actually a lot of people have tried it during the pandemic. Over 1 in 5 people who were doing online dating were also trying to do some video dates. And of those, over 70% of them said that they want to continue doing them after the pandemic. And from our data that that I collected with my colleague, Justin Garcia, we do this every year with Match, the dating company. It's called Singles in America. It's a huge survey every year. And we actually asked them in August, you know, are they, what is it about the video date? Like, what happened? And what was the good part? And people said that it actually provides a really good vibe check or compatibility check. So it's like, it's kind of like, you know, like the intermediate step between the text-based messaging and whether or not you want to meet them in person. So people are actually reporting that they liked this for that. I think it probably saves a lot of time. And I think it might also sort of relieve a lot of those worries, those anxieties about whether or not you might find that connection, or whether or not you might be compatible.
Dr. Amanda Gesselman is the Associate Director for Research at Indiana University's Kinsey Institute. Amanda, thanks for sharing your research with us. Really interesting stuff.
Thank you for having me.
So if you're out there dating again, I wish you the best in love or lust, whatever it is that you're looking for. Also, I hope you enjoyed the show. We love hearing from you, so continue to call us with your stories, or if you have a show suggestion, we're at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also tweet at me. I'm at MattKatz00, MattKatz00. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.